It's ad break time. I'm proud to announce that Beyond Solitaire podcast is sponsored by Central Michigan University's Center for Learning Through Games and Simulations. And as usual, they're up to some amazing things. Their next game, Hydrologic Cycle, is scheduled to come to Kickstarter on March 26th. CLGS also continues to offer classes in partnership with Gen Con. The next course, Jason Fury's Crowdfunding with Confidence, starts May 6th and will teach you all about board games and crowdfunding. Go check it out. Also, I'll include a final plug for myself. If you like the show and want to support it, you can do so by going to patreon.com/beyondsolitaire. Thanks to listeners like you, I've been able to keep upgrading my equipment, subscribing to StreamYard, and more. But for now, let's get on with the show. Hey, gamers, this is Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire. And this week on the pod, I am here with a very special guest. This is Dr. Jane Draycott. She's lecturer in ancient history at the University of Glasgow. How are you doing, Jane?
Hi, I'm all right. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm super excited to talk to you. So for those of you out there who do not know who Jane Draycott is, you should. But
you definitely should.
Absolutely. She's an expert on women in video games about the ancient world. As well as on Cleopatra's daughter, which we might also get to at some point in this discussion. Jane, the reason I invited you on the podcast was because you edited a volume recently called Women in Historical and Archaeological Video Games. So for the curious, could you tell us a bit about that volume and how it came together?
Oh, let me think. Right. Well, it's part of a much bigger project. So I had actually been asked to review an edited volume on classical video games. And I had said yes, because, you know, I play video games, I enjoy video games, and I also spend a lot of my time doing classics and ancient history. So I thought, yeah, bring those things together. So I read the book and I reviewed the book. And one of the things that I noted in my review was that of the 17 or so contributors to the volume, there were only two women. There was only one chapter that by one of these women that looked at women in video games, and the other female contributor was part of a group looking at something else. And so I noted in my review that this is rather unequal coverage, really, and that potentially that there should have been some consideration as to, you know, is this something that we should maybe solicit some more contributors, or we should think about the coverage or whatever. Because, of course, when you're doing an edited volume, it never works out exactly as you plan. People drop out or whatever. And sometimes people point stuff out to you later and you're like, oh my God, that was so obvious. I can't believe I didn't think of that. But at the time you were just, you know, you were in it and you didn't think. So I wrote this in my review, and then I was contacted by the editor of the series. The book was published by Bloomsbury. So I was contacted by the editor to say, well, maybe you'd like to. I'm probably not in that. It was an email. So, you know, probably not quite that tone. But it was basically a case of, you know, you said this, and now we want you to put your money where your mouth is and do something about it. And so I thought, yeah, okay, why not? Fair's fair. And at the same time, I'm very good friends with Dr. Kate Cook, who is at St. Andrews, who also is a very keen gamer, as well as being a very keen classicist. And we were, and this makes my life sound a bit more glamorous than it actually is, but we were in Paris. We were on a sort of girls' weekend in Paris, and we were just sort of wandering around the city, you know, being all, well, pretending to be sophisticated. And we were talking about video games as we were walking past, you know, the Pantheon, the Eiffel Tower and all that kind of thing. And so I told her about this, and she was like, "Oh, well, that sounds really interesting." And we just started talking and brainstorming, and we decided to do it together. And I swear, I did say it was a long story, but I am going to get to the kind of ultimate part of it, I suppose. So this was in December of 2019. And so early 2020, we, you know, after Christmas had come and gone, and we'd sort of talked about this a bit more, we were like, right, well, how should we do this? We can put together a call for papers. We can ask for people to submit papers on women in historical and archaeological and classical video games. And then COVID happened, and everybody went into lockdown, was stuck at home. And in the end, we didn't have a conference or anything like that. We put out the call for papers, and we got something like 50 50 abstracts from people. And we sort of thought, well, what do we do? How do we choose? How do we narrow this down to sort of 15 or thereabouts papers from 50? And so we thought, well, let's do two books instead of one. let's do a book that's about specifically classics, and a book that's about just historical and archaeological. And so, conveniently enough, the abstracts that we had, the 50 or so abstracts, they split quite nicely into these two different areas. And so, we decided to do that. Kate and I edited Women in Classical Video Games for Bloomsbury, and I edited Women in Historical and Archaeological Games for De Gruyter and their Video Games in the Humanities series. And so, yeah, we ended up with two really fantastic edited volumes all about women in different sorts of historical, archaeological, classical video games. And it's kind of, it seems to be the most interesting work I've ever done as far as other people are concerned. I get so many questions and sort of comments from people who've read the books, who want me to do podcasts or want me to do conference papers or panels or things like that. And so it's really, for something that was a kind of fun little side project during lockdown, it's kind of taken over my life. And now it seems to be the research area that is the most sort of dynamic as far as, well, the world is concerned, really. And so many scholars are starting to see the potential of video games for history and for archaeology. And just video games generally. And so this is something that I'm now spending a bit of time wondering, do I want to make this more of a sort of formal thing that I spend my time on rather than the sort of the fun side project that I do? Haven't decided yet.
Yeah, so this leads me to the question. You know, I feel like I finished my PhD in 2014. It was my graduation year, and I was in a religious studies program, but I do not feel like video games were a hot thing at the time. And if they had been, I don't know that my life would have taken the same course. So is this a recent thing? Is this something that I missed? Like, how would you say that the attention to video games from classicists has changed over the course of your career to date?
I think it's really interesting to think about that. And I do have some ideas. I don't know. These are just my own personal ideas. No proof. It's just assumptions. Partly, I think it's age, because I'm in my early 40s. And I think if for classicists who are working on video games at all, they are in their mid-40s or younger. There are lots and lots of early career PhD, ECR people now who are doing serious research on video games. But as far as going sort of up from that, I think it tends to be people in their mid-40s, and it tends to be side projects that they started doing for fun, but very much sort of subordinate to their proper classics research area. And I've got colleagues who are older than me who've never played a video game. So it is a generational thing. So I think it is people growing up in the sort of the late 70s, 80s, those were the children that had access to video games and then grew up playing them and sort of graduated from the sort of, you know, the Sega Mega Drive type stuff to the now the Xbox, the PlayStation. And so that's part of it, that simply people in their 50s and 60s, especially in sort of classics departments, they just never played them. And maybe their kids played them, but they never necessarily thought of them as something that was scholarly. And I can completely sympathize with that, because I started university in 2001, and classical reception was not a thing. You know, presumably people were at that time, you know, they were, Troy came out, Gladiator came out. So people were definitely interested in oh, here's a movie that's about the ancient world. Or here are Lindsay Davis and David. Here are Lindsay Davis's Falco novels and Stephen Saylor's novels and things like that. But it was more just a kind of fun thing that your academic interest, you could read these things or watch these things and your academic interest would be there and, you know, you could get the jokes and stuff. But to do that as academic work, I think was not really a thing back then. And I think it's really only in the last sort of maybe 10, 15 years, because even when people started doing research on classical reception, there was a lot of snobbery. Oh, that's not proper classics. That's media studies. That's film studies. That's what you do if you're not actually, you know, you're interested in classics, but you don't have the classical education or whatever. So there was a lot of snobbery about it. And then with video games, there's a lot of snobbery just generally about video games, you know, ruining our youth and all that kind of thing. And so I think that's partly why it's only really in the last sort of 10 to 15 years that people have started paying attention to classical reception and generally, and then video games as part of that. Also, I think it's sort of a kind of depressing result of capitalism, because video games make money. And so because they started making money, well, you know, they make billions, billions of dollars, billions of pounds. They're the highest grossing form of entertainment. They make more money than the movies, they make more money than music. So this idea that, oh, well, they make money, therefore they must be intrinsically valuable and they're worth spending your time on and they're worth spending your scholarly attention on. And then aside from those depressing things, there is, I think, the pandemic. People were at home and they needed to have entertainment. They needed to be able to escape from the sort of small confines of their house or their flat or whatever. And video games allow them to do that. And I think a big factor in that was the Assassin's Creed franchise and the games Origins and Odyssey, because obviously people have played the sort of strategy stuff like Total War, those sorts of things, for a long time. People played God of War for a long time. But I think the Assassin's Creed games, with their recreations of Hellenistic Egypt and classical Greece, that kind of caught people's eyes, classicists' eyes, even those that hadn't always played video games. They thought, oh, this is really interesting. I can play this and I can run around in ancient Greece or ancient Egypt, the place that has taken up so much of my time and my energy. Now I can do this. I can do it for fun. I can use it for teaching. And then that, of course, snowballs from there, because so many more classical games have come out in the last few years as well that have been really interesting and really accessible. So it's a whole many-stepped process, I think, not one sort of single individual thing.
Oh, no, it's really interesting. And you mentioned, you know, a lot of, quote, classical video games coming out. Like, when we talk about classical video games, what kinds of gaming experiences fall into that range? Because it's not just Assassin's Creed.
No, I mean, this is something that people, I suppose, should bear in mind, because I guess your first instinct is to go looking for the very sort of historical ones. So I mentioned the games like Total War, the sort of strategy games, and those have been around for a long time. The idea of having sort of being able to redo the military campaigns of Caesar and Alexander and other people, and very kind of Roman army sort of focused people. So there's that side of it. There's the historical side of it. There is the RPG side of it. So things like, I mean, people can play Assassin's Creed for, you know, the assassination, but at the same time, you could play it for the RPG and you can kind of just ignore the assassination and just run around the world collecting things and seeing things and doing photo mode and things like that. Then you've got the sort of mythological ones. I mean, this is where classics actually, it's quite common. You've either got the very sort of strategic military focused Roman stuff, or you have the Greek mythological stuff. And you know, but then I think as time's gone on, game developers have got more creative as well. They're doing more things in relation to ancient history, archaeology, mythology. But they're also that, you know, there are more genres and then you've got independent games as well. And you know, they sort of do all kinds of interesting things that have nothing much in common with the AAA games.
So when you are researching classical games, I'm going to have two questions about it, but the first one is just, how do you do it? Like, it's, how do you cite a video game? How much of it do you have to play in order to really get a sense? Do you just watch Let's Plays? Like, how is that labor done? And then how is it recorded for integration into academic work?
Right. Well, I probably have a different answer to this than other people, like I mentioned Kate Cook, for example. So I am a very selective gamer. I only like certain kinds of video games, and therefore I only play certain kinds of video games. I mean, I'm prepared to try things, you know, because if the story sounds like it's going to be interesting or something, but I like RPGs. I also like, I suppose, little sort of indie games as well, but I don't like first-person shooters. I don't like games that are too combat heavy. I don't like PC games, strategy games, those sorts of things. So for me, I will choose a game based on, firstly, do I actually want to play this? And if the answer is no, I do not want to play this. I don't play PC games. I play console games. And so if something's only available on PC, I'm not going to play it. As interesting as it might sound, I'm just not going to play it. And if it's not the kind of game that I enjoy, I'm not going to play it. Doesn't matter how relevant it might be to my research, just it's not going to happen. So there is that. Whereas Kate, for example, she plays everything. or perhaps not everything, but she goes into it sort of for the classics. Whereas I guess I go into it for the video games. And if there are classics there, then that's a bonus. Yeah, obviously YouTube and streams of people playing games. I mean, I've been using one of those recently. I'm currently writing a paper on The Forgotten City.
That was a really interesting experience. Yes, continue. See,
well, I hate that game. Or at least I love Skyrim. I love Oblivion and Skyrim and the Elder Scrolls games. And so the idea that there was a mod that originally grew out of the Elder Scrolls games and then became a sort of Roman history game, I was thrilled about that. And I played it on the Switch because that was what I had available to me at the time. And it is awful to play on the Switch. It is so sluggish and buggy and just there's no finesse to it at all. And I tapped out after a couple of hours. I was just like, I cannot sit here and play this.
I'm kind of glad for you on that, though, because you mentioned you don't like shooters. Well, I mean, you do love Skyrim, so that's okay. But, like, I was so mad that Forgotten City started out as this kind of low-pressure exploration game, and then suddenly there was combat partway through.
Well, this is the thing. And so because I'm writing a paper about this game, about an aspect of this game, which I haven't actually reached that part of the game because I gave up on the game. And so I'm writing two things, and one of the things that I'm writing I have played the part of the game that is relevant to it, but then there's this other part of the game I have not got to the game, and I am in a bit of a moral dilemma. I'm like, can I bear to sit down and force my way through this game to get to the bit that I need to get to? And well, I do not have the time to spend hours and hours playing a game that is a horrible experience to play. And so I have watched the walkthroughs, the parts of the game on YouTube. So I've watched a couple of different people's playthroughs to kind of get the sort of information and the I've taken screenshots of the text and things like that so that I have the actual, I mean, and this is what I would do if I were playing it myself. I would take photos of it, and I would then, you know, use those to sort of get the text and get the images and things. And I spoiled myself silly online reading about all the different endings. And in some respects, I am glad that I did not suffer through the rest of that game, because I would have been enraged if I got all the way to the end. And that was, I'm not going to spoil it for anybody who's watching or listening and hasn't finished the game. But I would have been so angry and disappointed, and I would have felt so betrayed. So that is how you do it or don't do it. And then you sort of, once you know, you play the game, or you know, you watch other people playing the game, you do research on, you know, you look for interviews with the developers. That can be great stuff online. If you can find some good interviews with developers that go into the process. I mean, the bigger AAA studios, they sometimes do documentaries. So I just watched the Naughty Dog Grounded Part 2 documentary. It was amazing and it's a fantastic insight into everything that they're doing. Some studios have a lot more information available to them than others. Big studios don't tend to get back to you if you email them, which I think they're missing a trick there, to be perfectly honest. Smaller studios can do, and then I've actually my chapter in the historical and archaeological video games book was about a game called Heaven's Vault made by a company called Inkle, and I think initially I slid into John Ingold's DMs. Possibly he's the creative director of that company. Either I slid into his DMs and said, you know, hi John, I'm a big fan of your work, you know, would you be open to sort of discussing the game with me? Can I email you? I can't quite remember because it was a few years ago now. Or I sort of emailed him basically saying the same thing, that, you know, I'm really big fan of this game. I'm writing about this game. Would you be open to answering some questions? And so then we sort of had a back and forth email exchange, and you know, he gave me permission to use photos in the book and on the cover as well. And so that's another way of doing it. You know, you actually get to talk to the developers. And then, of course, people do publish articles, scholarly articles. Obviously, there are more about older games than there are about newer games, but you can read those. And also fun, delving into the discussion forums online, get all sorts of interesting insights into gaming from there. So you basically would research it in much the same way, I think, as you would research anything else. You start off casting your net wide, trying to do lots of different things, trying to get lots of different insights, and then you find the stuff that's really interesting and what is relevant to what you're trying to do. So for my chapter, talking to John Ingold and sort of asking him questions about what he had chosen to do, that was what I was doing with that chapter. I wanted to know what was going on behind the scenes of that game. Whereas another contributor in that volume, he used his chapter was about the players and their thoughts on the game. So he used a lot of material from the forums about the games that he was interested in. And so, you know, you just sort of, you start off quite wide and then you gradually narrow your focus until you get the information that you need.
Yeah. And I also wonder, so one of the reasons for this set of questioning is that I recently interviewed Henry Lowood, who will have been on an earlier episode this season. You know, he runs the archives at Stanford. But one thing that also I'm fascinated by is, you know, links go dead, games go offline, especially now that we stream more and more of the games we play. Maybe somebody makes that YouTube video private that you used for your initial walkthroughs. What can you do in academic work to kind of preserve the citation so that it's still useful, even if something happens to the original source, to the original link, to even maybe the game itself?
Well, I think sometimes you just can't. I mean, and that is true not just for video games, but I mean, if you think about if a book goes out of print and there are no copies of it to be had, you can't cite that book. You know, if a journal is online only and then suddenly, you know, that disappears, you can't cite that. And so with video games, sometimes the links can be you know, sort of permanent links, and that's helpful. Other times, yeah, I mean, I suppose when something is published, it is something of a snapshot in time. And so the information in the publication is the information that you had at that time. And so the references are what was available at that time. So If you then go back to them later, and you know, this is one of the things when you're doing this sort of final preparation for something to be published, you do check all the links to make sure that the one that was used a year or two or however many years whenever the person originally used them, you do check them to make sure that they're still valid, and then you update, you know, the date accessed so that people know that. So yeah, I mean, I think there's only so much you can do about that. It is frustrating. I mean, a lot of games are not available anymore. One of the thing that I was using the Forgotten City for, I was doing for that, I was working on the depiction of medicine in ancient or historical video games. And so I was looking at different types of games and the different ways that medicine is used in them. So for that section, I was writing about educational games and the ways that you can make educational medical games. And there's a whole bunch of medical history games that are about outbreaks of plague or outbreaks of cholera and things like that. And there were a bunch that were made by university departments with either by the academics or by the students with sort of funding, so you know, decent games that had at one time been available online for people to play as educational games, they were all in Flash. So as of about 2 years ago, Flash gone, dead. So all of these games, the websites for these games still exist, and they still have the download the game here links. Games don't exist anymore, and I have to put this in my article. Unfortunately, you can't play these games anymore. I'm sure they would have been great, but you can't play them. And it is something that I think we do perhaps need to reckon with. Andrew Reinhardt has done work on, he sort of founded archaeogaming, I suppose, as a sort of research area. And the work that I do in archaeogaming is looking at the way that archaeology is depicted in video games, and that's one of the things that he does too. But another thing that he does under the sort of umbrella of archaeogaming is he looks at the archaeology of video games themselves, and that's both the sort of the physical archaeology, like digging up the Atari deposit that he did a few years ago, but it's also like the digital archaeology of video games. Like, how can you access, how can you preserve these things that never really tangibly existed there? And yeah, I mean, it actually does suit a lot of people that these things go, well, they cease to exist. I mean, it's the same thing with physical media, you know, films and TV series. It's very much in the news at the moment about films being, never released, deleted, no one ever having access to them again, so that movie studios can get sort of financial benefits out of that. And so in some respects, even the companies that are making this media do not necessarily want it to continue to be available. So we do have to think about that. I mean, I think perhaps it sounds a bit defeatist, but you can only do your best. You can only do what you can do. And you know, if something that you were working on no longer exists, I suppose you can try. I mean, I tend to assume that YouTube is there forever, and of course it's not, but I mean, I think if you've lost one particular playthrough, there'll still be lots more, because it's not just one person playing a video game, it's many people, and you can find these things if you go looking for them.
So kind of leading on to that, so you mentioned that you really focus on games that you actually want to play, which is very fair. You know, we've talked a bit about the ephemeral nature of these games, also fair. How does that, there are a lot of games now with kind of mythological or classical references. There are mobile games. There are, you know, it's the world is our oyster. But also, how do you make choices about which games you give the scholarly treatment, given that you don't, I mean, it's, of course, part of it'll be preference. Part of it'll be just what you've heard of, but also, you know, especially because so much of your work is about representation and kind of finding different narratives. How does that play out in terms of the games that you choose to give your attention to?
That is a really, it's a really opportune question to ask, actually, because I mentioned the Assassin's Creed franchise earlier, and I spent hundreds and hundreds of hours playing Origins and Odyssey and even Valhalla. I mean, it wasn't, I'm not in any way a sort of Anglo-Saxon Viking scholar, but the fact that they were running around in the ruins of Roman Britain, that was partly why I played that. However, I will no longer play Ubisoft games. I will no longer give them my time. I will no longer give them my money, and I will no longer give them my scholarly attention. I mean, I'm talking about them now, but you know, I will not devote any more of my very limited free time to that company. And do I need to explain why? I mean, is this something you think that people will not be aware of, or
maybe the TLDR version?
And this is actually. It is not just Ubisoft that has this problem. There are other video games companies, video game development studios that are exactly the same when it comes to the way that they treat their staff, the way they treat their female and non-binary and LGBTQ and people of color staff. Until these companies do better and start treating their staff better and actually start making their games more representative and respectful, I'm not prepared to give them anything, time, money, respectability even. I mean, that's the thing. By devoting academic attention to video games, you are making a statement that these have more to them than, you know, some people might think, and more credibility. I don't want to do that. So yeah, I mean, the sort of the more positive version of that, I suppose, is that I have very limited free time, just, you know, with my job and my family and modern life being the way it is. So I do have to be very, very selective anyway. Even if I wasn't naturally a very selective gamer, I would still have to be quite selective in, well, what platform is this available on? I, as I said, I don't play PC games. I mean, I have a laptop, I have a PC, but I don't play games on them because I spend enough time sitting in front of my computer. I don't want to spend my evenings or weekends doing that. So I will play games on, I have a PlayStation, I have a Nintendo Switch, and I do have an Xbox, but I haven't played that for a long time. I say my partner has all of these things. So he's a video game programmer. He works for a games company, actually. So yeah, between the two of us, we have quite a range of consoles and quite a range of games because we like very different games. So the sort of the practicalities of it dictate which ones in the first instance I might be inclined to spend time on. And then my own inclinations dictate even further. And yeah, it is, I would never say that it's a bad thing that there are so many choices for people who are interested in, you know, the classical world in video games, in the same way that I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that there are so many Greek feminist retelling novels available in bookshops. But you can't read them all, you can't play them all, you do have to make some kind of choice. And I've stopped reading the Greek feminist myth retellings because they're all pretty much the same. I've read about the Trojan War. There's nothing sufficiently different about the ones that are coming out now than there were about the ones coming out a couple of years ago. So I'm not gonna spend my time on that. And the same with video games, really. If it's not a genre that I enjoy, so like I said, I'm combat and no thank you. Then I'm not going to play it, which makes things a bit easier because a lot of games are very combat heavy. So you sort of remove those from the equation, it makes it easier. I don't play mobile games either, so that also makes that, you know, I don't have to engage with that side of things. And I think, I mean, you could argue that if you're going to be a sort of scholar working on video games, you must play everything, because how can you have any real insight if you don't play everything? But I think people have been making those arguments about books as well. You must read everything. How will you have any scholarly insight if you haven't read this obscure Russian only, version of this text? And I think, well,
just not like, do you really have to?
Exactly. Part of being a scholar, actually, part of finishing work and getting it published is knowing when to stop. Because if you decide that you need to wait until you've read these things, and you read those things, and then a bunch more things get published, and like, oh well, now I've got to read those too, and it just, you push it back and push it back and push it back. And I think you do have to say no. That is it. If new stuff gets published and it makes me change my thoughts, I'll write something else about that, but I can't incorporate that into this. And because scholarship takes a really long time anyway, I mean, minimum amount of time I think you can get stuff published in. Our two edited volumes for the video games, because we didn't have to have a conference, because we got the abstracts and then we got the chapters immediately in the summer of 2020 when everybody was in lockdown, those two books came out in 2022. So it was 2 years from sort of beginning to the end of the process. And we wanted it to be fast, because we knew that there were going to be more games coming out and there were going to be DLCs, and there would be some of the scholarship would have been superseded, etc. So we knew we had a very tight turnaround for that. And that's, I think, the way you've got to approach it, is that you do it and then you finish it and then it's out. And then, yeah, you can come back to it later and add to it if you like. But you just have to set your limits fairly early on. Otherwise, you will never finish anything. And you'll just never have any satisfaction whatsoever.
Hey, you can just start doing edited volume expansions and just pitch them that way.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is one of the ways to look at it, I suppose, is that if you have your own website and your own blog, you can do it as quickly as you like. If you're publishing in like online journals or something, it'll probably take a little bit longer. But absolutely, you can publish part two of whatever work you were doing, and look at it as DLC.
All right, so we're gonna come back to this, but first I do want to talk. So you mentioned that this started as a side project for you. When you started on the classics path, what did you think your main research area was, and do you still feel that way?
Well, when it's hard to know, really, because my classics path has been fairly windy. I mean, I started off, my undergraduate degree was in ancient history and archaeology. And then my master's degrees, I have one in ancient history and I have one in forensic archaeology and anthropology. And the reason I did those was because I gradually became interested in, well, I was always interested in people. I was interested in ordinary people, which is why I did archaeology as an undergraduate and then continued as a postgraduate. I wanted to know about people, and what better way to find out about them than looking at their bones and other things. And I became really interested in medicine, the history of medicine and the archaeology of medicine. And that is my main sort of first research interest, really, is I am a historian of medicine, archaeologist of medicine. There's no sort of quick kind of succinct way to say it, really. So my PhD, I did my PhD in classics entirely accidentally. It was simply that my local university, I approached three different universities that I could get to from where I was living at the time. And one of them just ignored my email completely. One of them emailed me back, but they were really quite obnoxious. And I was like, okay, I don't really, this is not good. And then the third one, the person that emailed me back was really nice and really encouraging. And he went on to actually be my PhD supervisor. And so I had a PhD in classics, not because I was a classicist, but because that was what they offered. They didn't have a PhD in ancient history or you know, any other sort of qualification. So I have a PhD in classics whilst not really considering myself to be a classicist. And so I, for the last 10, 12 years, 13 years since I got my PhD, because obviously we have now just changed year, I have been a medical historian, and that's kind of expanded a little bit to look at, it's not just medicine, but it's disability as well, and a little bit of sort of science and technology in relation to those things. So that is what's, I guess, comes out on my CV the most, and that is what is in my author bio and my researcher bio on my university website and things like that. So that's my number one research area. But I am at a point where I've finished off actually a lot of projects. I finished my most recent book, like my monograph, which was Prosthetics and Assistive Technology in Ancient Greece and Rome. And I actually do sort of feel like maybe I've said all I really want to say about medicine and about disability in antiquity. I don't think I have any new insights right now. I don't know if that's a sort of permanent condition or it's just a temporary one. But I have been looking at other things. I have been looking at, I've been doing some trade writing, popular history writing. And so I've been looking more at women's history for that. And of course the video games. The video games was not necessarily something that I saw myself doing long term, but because it's been the thing that people seem to be the most interested in, and it's the thing that seems to be the most sort of dynamic at the moment, as far as people working on it, organizations being set up to work on it. And so I am thinking, well, do I want to make this my main research area? And I'm not really decided, because as I said, I'm very selective about the games that I play, and I don't know if that necessarily does lend itself to working on this full time. I think I might have to expand my remit a bit more. But then I think, well, would that spoil gaming for me? If I may, I mean, my partner, who is a video game programmer, he says working for a games company, and people always think, he says anyway, and they always think it's such a cool job, you know. Oh wow, you get to play video games all day. And he's like, no, I don't. I hardly ever get to play video games. And in fact, he's only recently started playing video games again, just because of, you know, not having had the time and not having had the energy after like a full day's work of programming. So there is that danger that if you do what you love full time, either you burn out because you just can't stop doing it, or you stop loving it, and then you sort of think, oh, how can I find my love again?
I mean, isn't that just the full academic curse, though?
Yeah.
But so I also want to bring up, you, speaking of your interest in women's history, you also had a work of popular history come out in the past year. It was last year.
It came out in hardback at the end of 2022 in the UK, and then in hardback in the US in spring, summer of 2023. That staggered release over the last couple of years.
But you wrote Cleopatra's Daughter, so do you want to kind of tell people about that one really quick, just for fun, like, you know, how that connects to any other research you're doing?
Well, that's the thing, it does actually, because I did my PhD was on medicine and related issues in Greco-Roman Egypt. And so when I was doing my PhD, my sort of main focus was obviously on the sort of the medicine, the health, etc. But my side project was Cleopatra Selene. And that just after I finished my PhD, and you know, I've always felt that it's good to have a side project, because when you get really sick and tired of your main project, or even when you've reached a point with your main project that you can't go any further with it because you're waiting for something or someone, it's good to have a side project, because then you can go off and do that for a little while, and then you can come back sort of mentally refreshed, and you know, your enthusiasm is sort of refilled. And so my side project during my PhD in sort of the early years of my academic career was Cleopatra Selene and things to do with her. And I wrote a short article for History Today back in 2013. At that time I had thought, I could write a biography of her. I could write a popular history book of her. But I sent a proposal to loads of agents and nobody was interested. And so I used the research I had and I wrote an article for History Today because, you know, they paid and I needed some money because I was a poor early career researcher. And then that article, as we were talking about earlier, actually, that article, it was published in the paper version. Periodically, it would appear online because History Today sometimes pull out articles from their archives and they make them available online for people to read. So that was originally published in 2013. And then in 2018, it was pulled from the archive and it was made available online. And someone read it. And this someone was a new literary agent. And he said, well, he emailed me and he was like, I've read your article. And I was, I think it's really interesting. I think it would make a really good book. And I was like, well, little do you know that, you know, sort of 6 years ago, I thought exactly the same thing. And nobody else did. But clearly, you know, things have changed now. And so that was how that happened. I developed the article into a book. It is a popular history, historical biography of Cleopatra Selene, the only daughter of Cleopatra VII and Mark Antony. And it's about her very interesting life as separate from her parents, because she was able to basically succeed where they failed and do the things that they wanted to do. She was able to survive, for starters, but she was also able to become queen of a very significant African, North African Roman client kingdom. And she was able to rule alongside her husband and have a very sort of interesting life that was full of sort of ups and downs, you know, going from the subtitle in the UK version is Egyptian Princess, Roman Prisoner, African Queen. In the American version, it's what is it, from Roman Prisoner to African Queen or something like that? Or
I think that's right.
Yeah, they thought the subtitle was a bit too long, but I think
I like the UK subtitle personally.
Yeah, because it basically says, you know, she has a life as an Egyptian princess, and that's very sort of luxurious and prestigious and exciting. Then she's a Roman prisoner, and that's quite grim because, you know, her parents are dead and her brothers are dead and her future is dead. And then she becomes an African queen and it all comes back again. So very, you know, ups and downs, the wheel of fortune, that kind of thing. So I thought that she had a very interesting life story. People didn't really know about it. People know about Antony and Cleopatra. They don't really know much else beyond that. And yes, I wrote that book. That book is out. It's in bookshops. That's the other thing, of course. You know, you write academic books. They don't tend to end up in bookshops. They go on the shelves in academic libraries, and every couple of years somebody will like take them off the shelf, blow off the dust, and maybe use them. Whereas I really did want to have a book that was on a nice pile in a bookshop that, you know, random people would come across and think, oh, that looks interesting, and buy and then read. So that's been quite gratifying.
Yeah, and it's also, I feel like that's also something that's somewhat new for academics to have a component of their lives and careers where they get a literary agent and they publish popular history. You know, Helen Fry, it's like she's a World War II intelligence historian, has also started doing that. And I've been a big fan of her stuff. But, you know, I feel like it's really, really cool to see more, I guess, pop academic work. But I also feel like that's new. Is that a misperception, or do you think that is a new development in academia? And how do you think that is related, if at all, to things like also openness to engaging with pop culture and with video games and with reception stuff?
I think academics, there have always been academics on TV doing sort of documentaries and I guess on the radio and things like that. But I suppose not necessarily that many of them. And I, as far as classics and ancient history on TV is concerned, I think we have Bethany Hughes to thank for that, really. Back in the mid to late 90s, Bethany Hughes' documentaries. And she started, and she wrote, she did a documentary on Helen of Troy, and she did a book that went along with that documentary. And I love that book, actually. That's that is one of my favorite popular history, popular classics books, because it pretty much did everything that I ever wanted to do in that respect. It was worth reading, you know. It was not so sort of shallow and superficial as to simply be just like a summary of events, because some popular history books are, you know, they're just narrative histories. This happens. And some of them, they don't tell you anything new, because the author hasn't done any actual research. You know, not everybody who writes a book about the six wives of Henry VIII is actually doing research. You know, they quite a few of them are simply just using what's already out there and sort of repackaging it in a sort of pacey kind of way. And so, yeah, I think Bethany Hughes started it, and then that sort of cracked the door open to people like Michael Scott, Mary Beard as well. It was this you know, there was proof that people were interested in watching documentaries about ancient history. And the same thing with books, I suppose, is that Tom Holland has been writing Roman history adjacent books for 20 years. Adrian Goldsworthy, you know, there are plenty of people who have been writing popular history books. But I think perhaps what's new is the sort of the diversity. Diversity is not necessarily the word, but there's more of an openness to things that are not simply, you know, year by year, and not right. simply great not just another man bio life. Of
exactly.
Yeah. So you know, that's people want to read a, you know. They may want to read another biography of Julius Caesar, but at the same time, they also may want to read other things about ancient Rome. And I guess publishers realized that and decided that it was worth doing because it would make them money. So they were more open to taking on. I mean, I one of the things my agent said to me, actually, when I said to him, oh, well, you know, in 2012, nobody was interested in this. And he said to me, oh, well, what I have been told by publishers is find me young female historians, because we want more feminist history. And that's interesting in itself, because just last night, the Women's Prize announced their nonfiction long list. And this is the first year that the Women's Prize has done a nonfiction prize as well as a fiction prize. And one of the reasons, or the, I guess the main reason behind this prize being started up, is that women have not been getting recognition for their nonfiction of any kind. I mean, women do struggle have over many years struggled to be recognized for big literary prizes, fiction and nonfiction. And that does seem to have changed in the last few years, because prizes like the Samuel Johnson Prize and the Bailey Gifford Prize and other sort of history prizes are starting to include more women's history. And that's great, obviously, because women actually buy more books than men. And you wouldn't know it from I mean, I don't know how it is in American bookshops, but in British bookshops, if you go into the history section, loads of stuff on World War One and World War Two, and there are all these sort of grey, like grainy photograph, like man books, you know, books about Hitler and books about, you know, prime ministers and presidents and soldiers and, you know, the Band of Brothers type stuff of all the, you know, the plucky fighters that went off and did the sort of amazing things. And if you're looking for women's books, it's like, well, where are they? And like, oh, it's the Six Wives of Henry VIII. They are the historical women of significance. And so I hope that is starting to change, and that bookshops are starting to give more space to a different sort of history. And I mean, obviously, all the things that I'm saying about, you know, women's history, people of color have been saying for years about you know, diverse history. And again, in the last few years, we've started to see a bit of a willingness to tell different stories and to give those stories space. So hopefully it is going to well, continue and become embedded, become the norm rather than just the sort of, yeah, okay, you can have your little table over here rather than, you know, we'll put you in the main sort of shelving area.
This all leads me to believe too. I mean, I just want to ask, do you think that, I mean, I know that, I don't know how things are in Europe. I would say that academia in the United States is in a little bit of trouble. But at the same time, I'm very interested in like sort of the rise of more diverse pop history. And also, you know, when you're doing something like reception studies, it's a lot more interaction, I think, between academics and just regular people who are doing YouTube walkthrough or making a disgusting troll comment on Reddit or, you know, I feel like there's a lot more cross contact, both in terms of who your research is looking at for, you know, things to talk about, and then maybe also who your research is for. What has your work with gaming and, you know, writing something like Cleopatra's Daughter changed about who your audience is for your work?
Well, British academia is struggling in much the same ways as American academia, and it's entirely down to the Westminster government's terrible, terrible financial mismanagement of the country's economy over many years now. Universities are being starved of money, and so they are looking for ways that they can cut costs. And one of the things that they do is they close down academic departments. There's this perception that the humanities, the arts and the humanities are not necessary because they don't make as much money as STEM, which is entirely untrue. Britain's arts and humanities, well, I mean, we've just been talking about video games, you know, and how much money video games make. So it is really some sort of baffling creative accounting that's going on to say that arts and humanities are not, people are not interested in them, because people are really interested in them. And I think it is a good thing that they're so interested in the arts and humanities and in history and archaeology and things like that, that they are doing their own work on them. You know, they are reading the books themselves. They are doing, maybe they're doing short courses and things like that, or maybe they're just looking to things like, you know, novels and films and video games, and they're sort of working on those. And I have had responses from people who have read my books, who have heard me on the radio, who have heard me on a podcast. I mean, it's not as many as I would like, to be honest. I mean, it seems to be, I don't know, people don't tend to get in touch. You know, they maybe hear someone on the radio, and they might contact them and say, oh, I heard what you're saying. I thought it was really interesting. But that's happened a few times. People have email me about my book to say, I've had a couple of people email me to say that they have really enjoyed it. I've had a couple of sort of historical questions, and I have had one email actually just the other day that noticed a mistake and wanted to tell me about it. And I'm like, thank you. I will. I'm gonna try and address that for future editions. But that's literally like that's less than 10 people who I think have ever contacted me, and so I'm like, I hope that more than 10 people have read my work, because, you know, I would love to hear from people who do, and then, you know, I would because, you know, you do your work partly for you, partly out of your own personal satisfaction, but you also do it for other people because you want to. I mean, I'm an ancient historian. I am never going to be, you know, I'm not going to be making the kind of contribution to someone's life that a medical researcher who discovers, you know, how to stop cancer is going to make. But I do like to think that maybe I can make someone's day a little bit better. And I'd like to hear from them if I do that. Because, yeah, I mean, I don't think you should. I don't understand people, academics, who don't want to engage with other people, who don't want to engage with the general public. I can understand wanting to be very selective about when and how you do it, but I would like to think that my video gaming work is, if people are reading it, people who love games and are reading it, and it makes them think about things that they'd never thought about. They played the games for fun, but, you know, they'd never really thought about them beyond that. And if they can read the work, and then they can start thinking about video games a bit more critically. And if it makes them think about, you know, oh, I never thought that I could look at video games from an academic, sorry, the sun is kind of really coming through the window, and then my face must look very odd now on the camera. So if it makes people think that they can look at video games critically, and they can ask for more from their video games, you know, I mean, obviously, yes, entertainment, great, but if they can ask for a better depiction of women, a better depiction of minorities, better depiction of history, because it's not historically accurate, doesn't have to mean boring. There's so much crazy stuff in history that would be both amazing and hilarious for someone to adapt. So, you know, they having a historically accurate video game does not automatically mean it's a boring one that all the fun has been sucked out of. You know, there are plenty of incredibly historically inaccurate games that are really boring simply because the people who made them were just not that great.
So actually, this plea for engagement is a perfect spot to end our hour with a couple of just very soft questions. One, what have you been playing recently that brings you joy?
I have been playing Cult of the Lamb on my Nintendo Switch.
Ooh, that's a fun one.
Yes, I prior to that, I was playing Witchwood, and I loved that. That might actually be sort of edging out Skyrim and Oblivion as up there with my favorite games.
Oh, you like crafting?
I love crafting. This is the thing. I could happily just play a game. I was just like crafting stuff. And the funny thing about that is that I never played, you know, The Sims or Second Life or anything like that, because I came to gaming quite late. So potentially, yeah, I would have loved those games. I did play Farmville when that was on Facebook, and there was something very very soothing about, you know, and Animal Crossing also. That was why I got the Nintendo Switch in the first place in lockdown. Was to play Animal Crossing, and there is something very soothing about that kind of repetitive activity, and that's partly, I suppose, why I'm enjoying Cult of the Lamb, although the repetitive activity there is a wee bit darker than just tending your farm, although you are kind of, you're tending your cult, but yeah.
Yes, you know, you just gotta tend your cult sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then, given that you've mentioned an interest in hearing from people, where can you be found online?
I am on the hellscape that is Twitter. I am at JL Draycott. And, you know, one of the things that Twitter used to be good for was actually talking to people and getting into discussions and finding out new and interesting stuff. And it's so boring now. There is, I don't know if it's because all the interesting people left, or, you know, the algorithm is constantly just throwing like white supremacy and advertising in your face, but I do not get very, very much contact on Twitter anymore. I do not get very much engagement. I do not come across interesting people saying interesting things anymore. So maybe it's dangerous to open the floodgates and say, contact me on Twitter. But, you know, who could say? I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram as well. I have a website that I should update more than I do. And I don't know how easy it is to find online, to be perfectly honest.
I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, and I have my university website, and, you know, all my sort of official University of Glasgow stuff as well. So I am present online. I am visible and findable. There is another Jane Draycott. She is a poet, and we are constantly getting mistaken for each other. She gets my people wanting me, and I get people wanting her. Yeah, but we are two very different people with very different appearances and CVs. So I think if you Google Jane Draycott, you'll hopefully realize which one you want.
Oh, fantastic. So I will put all that in the show notes for people who want to contact you. And Jane, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a really cool conversation. I'm so looking forward to whatever you're up to next.
Well, thank you for asking me and listening to my ramblings for the last hour. I mean, this is one of the things about being an academic and being a sort of lecturer, is that you get paid, your wages to sort of stand in a room and talk at people. You do other stuff as well, but the sort of the most obvious thing that you get to do is you talk at people, i.e. students. And so it kind of can be a bit difficult to stop, actually. Like, you just, my partner says to me constantly, you know, you're lecturing me. I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to.
Well, for this hour,
sometimes I mean to, but, you know, not all the time.
Well, for this hour, it was very, very welcome. And for those of you who are out there listening, watching, please like, subscribe, comment, ask questions, and most of all, happy gaming.